what the Spirit says. And David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him?" Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lodabar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lodabar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. And David said, "Mephibosheth?" And he answered, "Behold, I am your servant." And David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always." And he paid homage and said, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall eat always at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord commands his servant, so will your servant do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he always ate at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. Dr. Timothy Paul Jones tells the story of taking his newly adopted daughter to Disney World for the first time. Though she was only 8 years old at the time of her adoption, this little girl had lived quite a messy, difficult life. She had been adopted once before, but because she had some behavioral issues and other difficulties, the family had a hard time raising her. And because of the many frustrations that they experienced with their new adopted daughter, every time they vacationed to Disney World, they would take their biological children but leave their adopted daughter with friends. After a few years, the family finally dissolved the adoption, allowing Dr. Jones to invade this little girl's messy life and welcome her as his daughter. And as soon as Dr. Jones learned the story of this little girl, he and his family immediately planned a trip to Disney World. But much to their surprise, as the trip drew nearer, her behavior grew all the worse. She began to lie and cheat and harass her brothers and sisters. When her father would correct her, she would say, "Are you going to leave me behind now?" And again, he would reassure her of his constant kindness. "No, this is a family vacation. You're part of this family. We're taking you to Disney World." But still, the closer the trip got, the worse she became. Even so, her actions didn't deter her father. Finally, they arrived at Disney World and spent a joy-filled day doing all the things you do at Disney World. That night, when they arrived back at the hotel, her father put his new daughter to bed and asked, "So, did you enjoy your first day at Disney World?" And the daughter pondered for a moment, looked up and said, "Daddy, I finally got to go to Disney World. But it wasn't because I was good. It was because I'm yours." Most of us probably don't have a story quite like this little girl, but in one way, we are all exactly alike. On account of the effects of sin, whether sin committed against us, sin in the lives of people around us, or sin in our lives that we have committed, our lives are messy. The lingering consequences of sin in the world make life messy and hard. How big of a mess has your life been? How much has sin made your messiness all the more messy? Well, what we learn in this story, and in the story of David and Mephibosheth, is that grace invades messy places. When we look at the life of Mephibosheth, we see how sin makes life messy. Mephibosheth was the son of Jonathan and a grandson of Israel's first king, King Saul. King Saul, you will remember, turned out to be a pretty wicked king. And when his wickedness continued to increase, David was appointed to be the next king. Then out of jealousy and anger, Saul spent the next 8 years trying to kill David and retain his kingdom. By the time we get to 2 Samuel 9, Mephibosheth is the last remaining ancestor of Saul. And it would not have been unexpected in that day for him to attempt to regain his grandfather's throne. Sin had marked Mephibosheth as an enemy from a rival kingdom. But not only was he an enemy, the effects of sin had left Mephibosheth as an orphan. On account of Saul's many sins, God would not go with Saul into battle. And in a battle against the Philistine army, Saul and all three of his sons were killed. Again, Mephibosheth is the last remaining ancestor of Saul's house. Sin had left Mephibosheth alone in the world. He was 5 years old when he became an orphan. But the mess just keeps on getting messier for Mephibosheth, because as we read in the text, Mephibosheth was crippled in both his feet. On the day that the Philistines killed Saul and his sons, Mephibosheth's nurse picked him up and fled the city, fearing that soon the Philistines would come and try to kill him. But in her haste, she dropped the 5-year-old boy, leaving him paralyzed, probably from the waist down. It's easy to think of all of the ways paralysis can make life more difficult, but in the ancient Israelite culture, the messiness was far more severe. According to Mosaic law, no person who was lame could participate in corporate worship. As a result, though it was not the intent of the law, those who were paralyzed were often viewed as outcasts in Israelite society. For many reasons, Mephibosheth's life was one of great shame. To highlight the messiness of the situation, the author tells us that Mephibosheth was living in the land of Lodabar. The name Lodabar means no pasture. Mephibosheth didn't have any of the wealth or land that had belonged to his grandfather. He was an impoverished, orphaned enemy of the king who had taken up residence in a dry, desolate wasteland. His life was messy. There's one thing we need to recognize here about Mephibosheth. As far as we understand, none of this messiness was caused by his own actions. We aren't told that any of Mephibosheth's sins caused these things. And that tells us something very important about sin. Mephibosheth's problem wasn't related to what he did, but to who he was. He was a grandson of Saul, counted as an enemy of Israel. You may be sitting here today thinking that your life is relatively in order and not messy in comparison with other people. But what we learn from Mephibosheth is that our biggest problems aren't caused by what we do, but by who we are. We are sons of Adam, counted guilty in him, and we are marked out as enemies of a rival kingdom. But what we learn in the story of Mephibosheth is that no matter how messy your life is, when grace invades, your messiness doesn't stand a chance. Your mess is no match for grace. When the Father's grace invades your life, when the Father marks you out as belonging to Him, no amount of messiness can stand in the way. The messiness of sin and its effects cannot prevent God's love from reaching you. You see, what happens in this story is that into Mephibosheth's mess stepped King David, who said, "Is there anyone left in the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness?" And in the same way, into our messiness has stepped the true and better David, Jesus Christ, who lived and died and rose again to show us the kindness of God. This morning, as we look at the kindness of David to Mephibosheth, I want to share with you six characteristics of invading grace. My hope is that if you have already tasted this grace, that you'll be encouraged and refreshed and renewed by the knowledge of it. And if you have never experienced invading grace, my hope is that you will come to see for the first time that no matter how great a mess you have made your life, God's love can reach you. So first, consider from this story that invading grace is predestined grace. If you were to sit down and start reading, say, from 2 Samuel 8, when you get to chapter 9, it may appear that David has been overcome with spontaneity. It may seem as if David woke up one morning and said, "I wonder who I can be kind to today. I wonder if who of my old enemies can I show some kindness to." Now, even that would be gracious, since Saul's family was a threat to his throne. But the grace that David shows is far greater than spontaneous grace. See, many years before this, even before David was king, David entered into a covenant with Saul's son, Jonathan. We read about it in 1 Samuel 20. Jonathan and David were the best of friends. And shortly after Saul began his years-long campaign to kill David, Jonathan came to him and said, "I'm going to help you escape. But it may cost me my life. So I want you to promise me, David, that your steadfast love will not depart from my house forever. Promise me, David, that no matter what happens to me, you're going to be kind to my children." And on that day, David made this covenant with Jonathan that he would be kind to his offspring. In 2 Samuel 9, David isn't being spontaneous. He's doing something he had planned to do for years. David's love for Mephibosheth didn't begin in 2 Samuel 9. It began in 1 Samuel 20. Brothers and sisters, God's grace is not spontaneous. God doesn't wake up and think to himself, "I'm feeling pretty good today. I wonder who of my enemies I can be kind to." That's not how grace works. You see, just like the covenant between David and Jonathan promising kindness to a grandson of Saul, so in eternity past, there was a covenant made between the persons of the Trinity promising kindness to many sons of Adam. It's called the covenant of redemption. The author of Hebrew called it the eternal covenant.
Jesus implied this covenant in John 6 when he said, "All that the Father gives me will come to me. And those who come, I will never cast out. I will lose nothing of all that he has given me." The good news of grace is that when grace invades your life, it's because God decided in eternity past to do it. God's grace worked this out a long time ago. God didn't start loving you the day you got saved. He's been loving you from before the foundation of the world. In love, he predestined us for adoption as sons, Paul said. And friends, predestined grace makes all the difference for messy people. God knew you were going to be a mess, and he loved you anyways. God knew you were going to be a mess, and yet he planned from before time to invade your life with his grace. What good news that all along, in spite of our mess, God was loving us. Next, consider from Mephibosheth's story that invading grace is rescuing grace. If you were driving down the highway and suddenly the car in front of you veered off the road and slammed into the guardrail and burst into flames, what would you do? You would not drive by slowly, roll down your window, and ask if they need help. You would slam on your brakes, you would jump out of your car, and you would go over there and pull them out of the wreckage. You wouldn't wait for them to make the first move. You would make the first move to rescue them. In the same way, what we notice in 2 Samuel 9 is that Mephibosheth wasn't making his way to David. David didn't wait for Mephibosheth to come. What does verse 5 say? King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir at Lodabar. The good news of the gospel is that God doesn't wait for us to come to him. He came to us in the person of Jesus Christ. When grace invades your life, it doesn't wait for you to crawl out of the burning car. It jumps in and grabs you out of your mess. And brothers and sisters, that's the way it had to be. God has to be the one to rescue us. Even if Mephibosheth had wanted to go to David, he couldn't. For all Mephibosheth knew, David only saw him as a grandson of his mortal enemy, as a threat to the throne. For all Mephibosheth knew, the second he stepped foot into the throne room of David, he was a dead man. But even more than that, Mephibosheth was crippled in both his feet. He couldn't get to David. He couldn't make his way from Lodabar to Jerusalem. David had to come for him. I'm sure there are some here this morning who look at the messiness of their lives and think it's up to them to fix it. You look around at all of your sin and you think you had better start doing all you can do to get to God. You say, maybe I am crippled, but I'm going to go ahead and crawl anyways. I'll do anything to get to God. Maybe that's why you're sitting here this morning. It's just another attempt to get there. Friend, I have to tell you that we're all just like Mephibosheth. Our mess is too great to get to God on our own. And in fact, we're even worse off than Mephibosheth. We're not just crippled, we are dead in sin. There are too many obstacles in the way. Doesn't matter how much crawling we do, apart from grace, we're stuck in Lodabar. And there are others this morning. You can see that your life is a mess because of sin. You know you can't make it out of Lodabar on your own. and you're despairing. You've begun to wonder if God's love is really enough to get you out of your mess. But whether you're here this morning and you're doing all you can to crawl and load a bar, or whether you're stuck there, I've got to tell you this morning that because of Jesus Christ, we can say with confidence that no matter how big a mess our life has become, it's not too great for grace. It doesn't matter what kind of sins you've committed. It doesn't matter how great an enemy you have been. It doesn't matter how desolate your low debar is. God's grace can reach to the lowest hell. You don't have to rescue yourself. You don't have to fear that you're too big of a mess. The wonderful, matchless grace of Jesus reaches and rescues us. Third, consider Mephibosheth and understand that invading grace is free grace. So at this point in the story, David has inquired about any in Jonathan's family to whom he might show kindness. He has learned about this crippled man who is living in Lodabar, and he has sent someone to go and bring him to the palace. I wonder what was on Mephibosheth's mind as he made that journey from Lodabar to Jerusalem. He must have been scared. He knew he was a grandson of Saul. He knew that his grandfather had tried to kill the new king. I'm sure that he was thinking that this was the end of the line for him. This mess was going to be brought to an end in David's throne room. I can't help but imagine that on that journey, Mephibosheth was rehearsing in his mind what he was going to say to David. When I get before the king, I'm going to fall on my face. I'm going to tell him that I know he's the real king and I don't want to be king. And then I'm going to tell him that if he'll just let me live, I'll do whatever he asks. I'll be his servant. I'll serve him the rest of my days. Whatever I have to do, I'm going to earn his favor. That's what happened in verse 6. Mephibosheth falls down before David. When David calls his name, he says, "Behold, I'm your servant. I'm ready to pay it all back, David. Just tell me what I have to do and I'll do it. Don't kill me." Mephibosheth's actions here sound very familiar, don't they? Sounds much like the words of the prodigal son in Luke 15. He made the journey back to his father after living a life of terrible sin. And as he walked, he rehearsed that speech over and over and over again in his mind. "I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Just let me be a servant." Isn't that how we think so often? "God, I'll do anything. I'll pay any price. I'll work it off if you'll just forgive me. What must I do to be saved?" But listen to how David responded to Mephibosheth. "Do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan." Mephibosheth, you've got nothing to fear. I'm going to be kind to you regardless of what you can do for me. I'm going to be kind to you regardless of what you have to offer. You don't have to pay anything back. You don't have to work it off. This is about my kindness, not about what you can do for me. Here is one of the most important life-changing discoveries that can be made about grace. If grace has anything to do with you, if grace is in any way dependent upon what you can do or what you have to give, it's not grace. If grace isn't free, it ceases to be grace. If grace requires something from the recipient as a condition for receiving it, it's not grace. And what good news that is. Because like crippled old Mephibosheth. We've got nothing to offer. He couldn't have been a servant in David's house if he wanted to, because he was crippled. He had no way to pay David back for grace. He had no land. He had nothing to offer. And neither do we. All our works are like filthy rags. But praise the Lord. When we had nothing to give, God gave us everything in Jesus. Jesus paid it all. Jesus paid it all. God can give us grace without requiring anything from us to receive it, because Jesus paid it all. You don't have to work it off. You don't have to pay God back. It's finished. Remember how the father responded to his prodigal son? The boy had his speech all prepared. But when he got back home, the father stopped him before he said a word. You're not going to be a servant in my house. My grace is free. Next, I want you to see that invading grace is lavish grace. Once there were two little boys who finally crossed the line. Their mother had done everything she could do to discipline her children and correct their behavior, but nothing was making a difference. And now they had really done it. Their mother had had enough. She put them in the car and began to drive. The boys knew this time they had really screwed it up. They were sure Mom was driving them to Daddy's office, where they were going to get the smackdown of their lifetime. But the mother drove right past the father's office and just kept on driving. Just as the boys were beginning to fear that she was going to leave them in the woods somewhere, she pulled in to Dairy Queen and bought them both ice cream and taught them a lesson about grace. Mercy, she said, is you not getting what you deserve. But grace, grace is you getting what you don't deserve. Grace invades and grace gives. In verses 7 and then in verses 9 to 12, David lavishly pours out blessing after blessing on Mephibosheth. There are two. David gives Mephibosheth an inheritance. David gives him all the land and wealth that had previously belonged to Saul, as well as the servants to tend the estate for him. In the blink of an eye, David goes from impoverished resident of Lodabar to wealthy estate owner. But the lavish gifts just kept on coming. Not only is he given a vast estate, but in verse 7, David says to Mephibosheth, "You shall eat at my table always." And in verse 11, we learn from this point forward, he ate at the king's table like one of the king's sons. In his most lavish act of grace, David adopted Mephibosheth as his own son and gives him all the rights and privileges that come with being a son of the king. On account of David's grace, Mephibosheth is no longer impoverished. And no longer is he an enemy or an orphan. He is a valued son of King David. What we're meant to see in 2 Samuel 9 is that lavish grace cleans up our mess. The shame that accompanied Mephibosheth has been dealt with. It's because of David's lavish grace that Mephibosheth can finally live up to the meaning of his name. Mephibosheth means destroyer of shame. Beloved, that's what grace does. It cleans up our mess, removing the shame of it. And it does this not merely by forgiving our sin, but by granting us blessings we do not deserve. Just like Mephibosheth, in Christ we have been guaranteed an inheritance. Ours is not earthly, but eternal. One day we will reign with Christ over His estate, the new heavens and the new earth. And like Mephibosheth, we've been adopted as sons of God and granted all the rights and privileges of being His sons. When grace invades your life, grace outgives your mess. Fifth, consider that invading grace is undeserved grace. We mentioned this a moment ago, but it's worth stating more fully here. Don't you love how Mephibosheth responded to David's lavish grace in verse 8. Mephibosheth paid homage to David and said, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" I love how Matthew Henry put it. He said, "Though the son of a prince and the grandson of a king, yet his family being under guilt and wrath and himself poor and lame, he calls himself a dead dog before David." David, why would you do this? I don't deserve any of this. My grandfather was your mortal enemy. Why are you treating me this way? This is too much kindness. I'm nothing but a dead dog, David. Church, that's exactly the point. Of course he didn't deserve it. Of course, there was nothing in him worthy of receiving a blessing, but that's what grace is. The undeserving getting what they do not deserve. If grace is deserved, if grace goes to those who possess some quality that makes them deserving of grace, it's not grace, it's payment. And if it's payment, then we should do everything we can to ensure we deserve to be paid. But praise God, He doesn't give His grace to people who deserve it. Indeed, the only way you can receive grace is to understand that you don't deserve it. Just imagine how different this story might have been if Mephibosheth had said, "Well, David, it's just about time you gave me my grandfather's inheritance. I've been sitting down there in Lodabar for all these years. I'm a prince, David. I deserve the money. I deserve the land. You had no right to withhold that in the first place." Friend, if you're here this morning and you've come to a point in your life where you think you deserve God's grace, then you ought to question whether or not you've really received it. If you have experienced grace, you'll understand that you could never deserve it. The more you come to understand just what God has done for you in Jesus, the more you come to see yourself as a dead dog in comparison. If you find yourself thinking you are for some reason worthy of God's grace, what you need to do is take a long look at who you really are. A guilty son of Adam. You need to see just how messy your life really is. And then you need to look again at Jesus. You need to consider how He lived and died and rose again in your place, that an undeserving sinner like you might receive adoption into the family of God. And if you do know you're a dead dog, all you have to do is sit back and enjoy grace. When you come to see yourself as totally undeserving of grace, then you'll be in a great position to receive it. Finally, this morning, I want you to see that invading grace is keeping grace. Look at the way chapter 9 ends. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. Isn't that interesting? David just gave Mephibosheth his own estate with dozens of servants to work the land for him. He's got his own food now. He's got his own table now. So why does Mephibosheth stay in Jerusalem at David's table? Well, I think what happens later to Mephibosheth in 2 Samuel can help us understand that question. In chapter 16, Ziba, the servant who told David about Mephibosheth and who was assigned to serve him, betrays Mephibosheth. In that story, there is some turmoil in the kingdom, and David's throne is almost up for grabs in a sense. And Ziba seizes the opportunity and lies to David, saying that Mephibosheth is plotting to take the kingdom from David. David believes Ziba and gives him all of Saul's land. A few chapters later, in chapter 19, David confronts Mephibosheth about this. Mephibosheth tells David what really happened. Ziba betrayed him and headed off to talk to David and tell him these lies. But since David can't be sure which one of the two is telling the truth, he says to Mephibosheth, "I tell you what, let's just split the land between you and Ziba. You take half and he'll take the other half." And Mephibosheth says, "Let him take it all, for my Lord has come safely home." In other words, "David, I don't want the land. I just want you. David, I don't need wealth. I don't need my own table because I'm a son at your table. I don't need land. All I need, David, is your kindness to me." The reason Mephibosheth stayed in Jerusalem, the reason he was willing to give the land to Ziba, was because the kindness of David meant more to him than anything else. Brothers and sisters, once you've experienced invading grace, you don't need anything else. Grace keeps you. Grace holds you. Grace causes you to persevere. And that is significant in light of the very last sentence of chapter 9. He was lame in both his feet. Mephibosheth never stopped being lame. The effects of living in a sin-stained world didn't fully go away, and therefore all his days, Mephibosheth needed the kindness of David. Beloved, grace invades. But while we live in a sin-stained world, we must still deal with the messiness of sin. And therefore, we are never going to outgrow our need for the grace of Jesus. But the good news of invading grace is that once it's there, it never lets go. Once the king marks you out as his own, he is never going to turn you over again. He will never dissolve your adoption. He'll keep supplying all of the grace that you need. "Daddy, I finally got to go to Disney World. But it wasn't because I'm good. It's because I'm yours." When grace invades your life, it deals with your mess and lavishly blesses, not because you deserve it, not because you can pay for it. If grace is based on anything you can do, it's not grace. Grace invades your life because God marked you as being His. And then He sent His Son to live and die and be raised again so that in Him you might experience adoption as sons and receive an inheritance. Truly, because of invading grace, no matter how great the messiness of your sin, all who are in Christ can say, "I am Mephibosheth. God has destroyed the shame of my sin." Let's pray.